Good afternoon from listener-supported community radio. This is KKRN 88.5 FM. This is Wake Up Call, and I'm your host, Doug Craig. Our engineer is Randy Compton. Say hello.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Randy, for being here. Wake Up Call is an effort to create a space through which the truth can shine. Our planet is undergoing unprecedented and massive transformation, while most of us are unaware of what this means. It's time to wake up to the climate crisis and accept our role as healers of the earth. And today I'm super excited. We have Simon Donner, Dr. Simon Donner, on the show for us today. He is an assistant professor of climatology in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. He leads a broad program of teaching and research at the interface of climate science, marine science, ecology, and public policy. Dr. Donner joined UBC in 2008 after several years working as a scientist among the lawyers, economists, and policy analysts at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. His research team examines the societal and ecological impacts of climate change with a focus on coastal ecosystems like coral reefs and helps develop effective strategies for adaptation and mitigation. Professor Donner is also actively involved in public outreach. He regularly blogs about climate change and speaks in public forums. On his website, which is simondonner.com, Dr. Donner writes, "I study why the climate matters to society as well as to ecosystems like coral reefs." Dr. Donner is also an Aldo Leopold Leadership Fellow and a Google Science Communication Fellow. And besides being a professor of geography at UBC, he is also an associate in UBC's Lew Institute for Global Issues, the Biodiversity Research Center, Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability, the Atmospheric Sciences Program, and the director of UBC's Ocean Leaders Program. Dr. Donner got his bachelor's degree from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. He has a master's degree in the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University, and he got his PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in atmospheric and oceanic sciences, with a Center for Sustainability on the Global Environment. So quite an impressive background. And as we get into our show today, Dr. Donner, I want to know why you chose to study and teach about the climate crisis. What is it about this particular issue that you find so compelling?
First of all, thanks for the introduction. I haven't heard my resume read like that in a while. Why did I choose to study the climate crisis? That is a great question, because I don't think I actually chose to study it. Like most people that become climate scientists, I was a young person that was good in math and physics, because at its core, the science of climate change is just an extension of physics and chemistry, right? It's not necessarily a new set of theories or anything. It's just an application of what we know, about physics and about chemistry to the atmosphere and to the oceans, and they lead to the conclusion that humans are changing the climate. And so I got into this because it was something I happened to be good at, and that I was just interested in how, you know, the atmosphere interacts with other things, just as sort of a geeky scientist at the time. I did not, at the beginning, really appreciate the extent to which I was diving into something that was a that was going to become a political football, but also that was going to be, you know, the problem of the century. I just was, like most climate scientists, I just happened to be good at math and physics.
For anyone who's confused about the causes and effects of what we now call the climate crisis, at one time it was referred to as global warming or climate change, can you lay out the basic connection between our use of fossil fuels and how our climate is becoming increasingly unstable?
No, I'm sure, and I'm happy to. So the climate, just to be clear, is, when we say climate, we're kind of talking about sort of the long-term average and range of the weather, right? So it is, the weather is what you get. The climate is what you expect, the range of average conditions, and the weather is what you get. And so when we say that the climate is changing, we just mean that the average conditions are, average in the range of conditions are changing, and because it's getting warmer, that means if the average is getting warmer, it means we're getting more extreme heat, and also more extreme rainfall, and all sorts of other things. And so as scientists, you know, what people have been studying for decades, really over a century, is, you know, what are the different things that influence the climate system, and among them being obviously how much energy we're getting in from the sun, the composition of the atmosphere, et cetera. And since the mid-1800s, the concentration of certain gases in the atmosphere that we call greenhouse gases, which include carbon dioxide but also gases like methane, have been increasing the atmosphere, and the major reason for that is the burning of fossil fuels. This is no secret. This is something that you can measure in the atmosphere. This is something that there's even a chemical signature in the carbon dioxide that's been added to the atmosphere that shows that it came from fossil fuel burning. So there's no secret about this. And it turns out that these gases, although they're pretty low concentrations in the atmosphere, play an outsized role in the energy budget of the planet. And it's because gases like carbon dioxide and methane rotate and vibrate in a particular way. And this is when I say that, you know, I got into this because I just happened to be good at math and physics. This really is just about physics, the structure of the molecules, carbon dioxide, differently than, say, the structure of an oxygen molecule in the atmosphere. The structure means that it vibrates and rotates in a certain way so that it can absorb a certain type of energy. And that's the type of energy that gets emitted by the planet's surface. So by having carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the planet's warmer than it would be otherwise. This is good news, right? Otherwise, the planet would be about 33 degrees colder, Celsius, I should say, so much larger Fahrenheit, without the CO2. So having CO2 in the atmosphere is a good thing, but if we add more, as we are clearly doing from fossil fuel burning, then the planet should warm up. And so this comes from really basic scientific theory. I mean, it's drawn from the same physics and chemistry that's been in textbooks for over 100 years. That's what we expect we should be seeing from the first principle, and then it is what we observe. We do see the planet is warming, and we also see that it's warming in a way that could only be explained by greenhouse gases. And this is the last thing I'll just sort of point out. Sometimes people ask, how do we know it's not the sun? Well, first of all, we have measurements of the output of energy from the sun to show that it's not that change is not significant enough to warm the planet as much as it has. But the other reason is how the atmosphere is actually warming. The upper part of the atmosphere is not warming. Only the lower part of the atmosphere is warming. And that's where greenhouse gases are. And so if the sun were warming the planet, you'd expect every molecule in the atmosphere to be warming up. And so it doesn't matter what height you were in the atmosphere, it would be getting warmer. But that's not what's happening. Only the lower part of the atmosphere is warming. That's where greenhouse gases are. That's where they're absorbing energy that's given off by the Earth and re-emitting that energy back down to the surface, right? And so it's kind of like a smoking gun that shows us that it's clearly greenhouse gases that we can chemically show are from fossil fuels that are warming the planet. And scientists, the confidence about this in the scientific community is about the same confidence that cigarette smoking causes cancer. There really is no doubt in the legitimate scientific community that this is happening.
And for our listeners who want to learn more about what Dr. Donner's talking about, you can Google stratospheric cooling. That's the upper atmosphere. The lower atmosphere is the troposphere. And so there's that heat-trapping blanket in between those two regions, and it's cooler above the blanket and hotter below it, just like it is in our bedrooms on a winter night. So let's talk more about CO2 emissions. Before humans walked the Earth, levels rose and fell between 180 and 280 parts per million. And since the Industrial Revolution, these numbers have been rising steadily, and now are about 415 parts per million. And I think each year they rise about 2 or 3 points. Why is this a concern? Why should we be worried about that number keep as it keeps rising?
Well, you know, I think we just know this, people know this from all different walks of life. I mean, change isn't necessarily a bad thing. The issue usually comes when it happens faster than you can adapt. And that's really the essence of the problem, right? That the climate is changing as a result of this changing of how we're changing the chemistry of the atmosphere. And it's changing faster than at any point in the history of human civilization. In fact, really almost the history of our species. And that may sound bombastic, but CO2 levels right now are higher than they've probably been for about 3 million years. And, you know, there haven't been Homo sapiens for 3 million years. Right? And so we're emerging out of an envelope of climate that we developed in. And I don't just mean our species, but civilization. So in the past 10,000 years, the climate has been reasonably stable. There have been some ups and downs, but we're merging way outside that envelope, and we're doing it quite quickly. And so it means that, you know, it's going to be very difficult for society and for different different species and environments out there on the planet to adapt. Right. And so the thing I always try to tell people is not that climate change is inherently a bad thing. It's just happening faster than we can adapt. And so that's why so many people are pushing, calling this a crisis and saying we need to slow the rate of climate change to reduce the damage it'll do to society.
You live and work and teach in Canada, which has kind of a mixed record, like any nation does on this issue. The bad side, I suppose, the nation is the source of the tar sands, which is a particularly dirty fuel, I suppose, in the process of extracting it, producing it. On the other hand, Canada's kind of a world leader in developing, I believe, a nationwide carbon tax that I think started in your area in British Columbia. Can you help our listeners understand what that's about?
I'm happy to. You know, Canada is actually, I really think of Canada sort of like a hot spot for climate change. The country is actually warming twice as fast as the rest of the world, and that's something that scientists expect. It's because we are a big, cold, northern country, and we have a lot of snow and ice, and when snow and ice melts, you leave behind a darker surface. That darker surface more absorbs more energy, and so you get a bit of a run-on effect. And so Canada's warming quite quickly. There's lots of reasons for Canadians to be concerned about climate change. And we've had, I think, just as you've seen in the U.S., governments that have gone back and forth on how important the issue is. And so we've had, governments that tried to be more active, governments that have been less so. Not that different, but sort of the swings you've seen between the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and then the Trump administration. In my province of British Columbia, though, I think what's really amazing is that the carbon tax was created back in 2007. It's been in place for 12 years, and it hasn't caused unrest or all sorts of different problems. It's generally been effective. The tax price is not very high, so it doesn't have a huge impact on a decision somebody might make to fill up their tank at a gas station. But it does have an impact on decisions made by big organizations like my university when they see how much they're spending overall on paying the carbon tax on fuel, on energy, et cetera. that makes the institutions decide to invest in other technologies. And so it's actually been quite effective. But what's most important about that tax is it was not put in by a left-wing government. It was put in by a conservative government. The government at the time, because the leader of the party at the time was concerned about climate change. And so part of the reason politically that it worked so well is because of which party it came from. And so that was really interesting. And then since then, the current federal government has basically aimed to mimic that across the country. It is being fought by the different provinces. So just like in the U.S., it can be hard to implement something federally if some of the states don't agree. And so there are provinces that are fighting the introduction of the carbon tax, but legally it is there, it is in place nationwide.
If you're just tuning in, this is Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM. You can also find us at kkrn.org. Listener-supported community radio. I'm Doug Craig, and our guest today is Dr. Simon Donner. He's a climatology professor at the University of British Columbia and has a website at simondonner.com. And on that website, you write, "Climate change is about legacy. The decisions we make today will help determine the future for people and for the planet. My core objective as a scientist and also a citizen is to translate scientific information and present different perspectives in order to help society make those decisions." And I know you're a fan, as I am, of the late Dr. Stephen Schneider, who was fairly well known for his sense of devotion or dedication to communicating the reality of climate science and climate change to the public. Whereas that's kind of unusual. A lot of scientists don't see that as their role, but you clearly do. Can you kind of explain why that's important?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I think it's actually important for more and more science. I think there's this notion of science, of scientists as, you know, they're supposed to be, they're objective, they're robots, they just answer the questions, they don't take values into account. But, you know, I think that's changing a lot. And I also think it's changing in a way that's sort of going back to how science used to be, before the 1950s. If we think about, you know, the most famous scientists in the world, the names we think of, Albert Einstein comes to mind. Albert Einstein was one of the most outspoken people, and he was beloved for it, right? And I think this idea that scientists aren't supposed to speak out about issues is wrong, because if the experts on the issue don't speak up, who's going to, right? If somebody calls me and asks a question about climate change policy and I say, I'm a scientist, I don't really feel like I should answer, who's going to answer that question instead, right? And it's not that I'm smarter or scientists are smarter than other people, but we have time, we spend a lot of time thinking about these issues. We should talk about it. I don't think we should be afraid to. And I think the good news is, I'd say scientists of my generation and people after me, that's definitely the case for. I don't think I'm unusual. I think the idea that we need to talk about this problem is important. I personally feel it, in part, out of being Canadian and out of working at a Canadian university. Our university system in Canada is public, which means it's publicly funded. Our money comes from the taxpayers, and I sit at meetings with other professors all the time and remind people that, listen, people are paying taxes so that we can do this for a living. So we need to talk to them about what we're learning and what it means for the decisions they need to make. So it's not, a bunch of elites at a university trying to play God. It's people trying to pay back the taxpayers who are investing in the work that's being done at the university.
So many of us are disconnected from the natural world. We live and work in cities, many of us do, and kind of go through our life just taking for granted the fact that we have clean water and clean air and And we have these amazing electronic devices we carry with us that connect us to one another, but do serve to disconnect us from the natural world. But there are still people who whose livelihood very much depends on the changes happening to the natural atmosphere and soil and et cetera. And one group of individuals who are impacted by that are farmers. And I know you've had some contact with farmers. And regardless of their political leanings, any farmer in the world is very aware that the climate's changing. And I just wonder if you could talk about that and what your experience has been talking to farmers.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I'll be honest though, I have done less of speaking to farmers in the past few years than to people in other walks of life. But I think, farmers are just an example of the many people in North America that they really experience the weather and climate every day, right? And I think the thing that is frustrating for probably a lot of Americans, for a lot of Canadians, and I'd say for me as well, is that climate change for so long has been talked about. You say climate change, people think of polar bears, right? They don't think of people, right? And this, climate change is not an environmental problem. I mean, yes, it affects the environment, but if you go back and think about what we used to call environmental problems, when that started, that movement sort of really started in the 1970s, we're talking about, saving land, protecting land from disturbances, creating parks, saving the whales, etc. They were somewhat direct action problems where there was a pollutant or there's a development coming, and if you block that pollutant, block that development, the piece of the environment would be saved. But climate change is really different, right? Climate change is a case where we are emitting something to the atmosphere over long periods of time, and that is changing the atmosphere, changing the weather that will be experienced in the future. And as a result, so there's no direct cause and effect the way there is with other environmental problems. It's very diffuse, and the decisions we make today are going to have a really long legacy. And so in that way, climate change is really a legacy problem, as I mentioned before. And so it's a lot more like dealing with something like poverty, right, where there's no one solution. Right? There's no silver bullet. There's a whole bunch of different things we can do. There's a lot of different approaches you can take, but they're all necessary if we want, things not to get worse in the future. And so I just, so one of the things I often talk to people about, and just sort of almost, I wouldn't just say remind them, but sort of help people realize, is just how much the weather affects their daily life, how much the climate affects their daily life, and that this problem isn't just about this sort of other that we call the environment. It is really about us.
And another group that's intimately connected to the changes in the climate are individuals that live on islands and in coastal communities. And you spent a big part of your academic career studying a particular group of islands in the, I believe it's in the Central Pacific Ocean. And if people have seen the word, it looks like Kiribati, but I guess it's pronounced Kiribus. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, depending on the accent, Kiribus or Kiribus or Kiribati.
Kiribus. Okay. So you spent a lot of time there, and the climate crisis is clearly impacting them. They clearly see it. Just curious, what you've learned. How many times have you been there? Why did you go there to begin with? And what have you learned? What are you continuing to learn from your experiences with those people?
It's a really, really great question. And I've been doing field research on and off in the Pacific Islands, particularly this country named Kiribati, since 2005, I admit that it started as a bit of a lark, as a bit of my own curiosity. As a student studying climate change, you spend a lot of your time, solving math and physics problems, working on computers and everything, and I was always struck by the irony that I was studying atmospheric science from inside an air-conditioned building, right? And that I was studying ocean science, which is sort of part of understanding the climate system, at the time at the University of Wisconsin, which, of course, is in the middle of the continent, 2,000 kilometers from the nearest ocean. And I felt that, as a student, that I've learned the science here, but I don't feel like I've learned what it means to people. And so after I graduated and was working as a researcher at Princeton, I took a break from work and traveled to the Pacific Islands and to a few other places to meet with people in different communities and get their perspective on what they were experiencing. Not so much just about climate change, but just to understand kind of like what we're talking about with farmers. Like, how does climate affect your life? Because it's different everywhere in the world. And and as a result of that, I developed relationships with people in Kiribati, and I have now been working with the government there for almost 15 years, trying to understand what can be done to adapt to sea level rise, trying to understand how the coral reefs there are being affected, and a variety of other things. And so my students and I go and do field projects there. We collect data and whatnot. And the most important thing is that the stories you hear about impacts of climate change in other parts of the world, they're true, but they're also often filtered through, you know, the lens of how we see the world, right? And so if you imagine the Pacific Islands as a place where people are vulnerable, well, then you're going to see vulnerability there. And so, you know, the Kiribati is a place where there's very little land that's more than 2 to 3 meters above the ocean, which means it's very vulnerable to sea level rise. But it also doesn't mean that people are entirely helpless. And what can be a bit frustrating, I know for colleagues of mine there, and certainly for myself and students of mine that work with people there, is to see sometimes these places in the Pacific Island kind of get used as a narrative device in a debate we're having in North America, right? Where we point to these and talk about, you know, disappearing islands in the Pacific because it helps us make an argument here, right? Whereas those arguments, though well-intentioned, you know, travel to the Pacific Islands and affect people there and affect the way they think.
We're talking with Simon Donner, Dr. Simon Donner. He's a climatologist at the University of British Columbia. And you're on KKRN, listening to KKRN 88.5. I'm Doug Craig. The show is Wake Up Call. We'll be right back after this break.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. And Lenny Bruce is not afraid. Self-churn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it off an ox, speak, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear, bite down. High wire and a fire representing 7 games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to west are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck. Team, my team, reporters, baffle Trump, tether crop. Look at that, no plane, fine, then. Uh-oh, overflow, population, common poop, but it'll do. Save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs. Listen to your heart.
Good afternoon. This is Doug Craig on Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5, and we're speaking with Dr. Simon Donner, a climate science professor at the University of British Columbia, and we're talking about Kiribati, an island nation in the Central Pacific, which most people probably don't know too much about. They have about 110,000 people. Most live on Tarawa Atoll.
In the main island.
The state comprises 32 atolls and reef islands, 800 square kilometers, dispersed over 3.5 million square kilometers, I believe is about the size of India. They kind of straddle the equator. So just a real fascinating place, and I found in my my research before the show today, I found an article from NBC News talking about one of the islands that's disappeared called Te Bunako. And it disappeared along with an 11-acre Hawaiian island and a small Arctic island. And so just the question is simply, is this our future as our planet warms and glaciers melt and sea level rises? You know, sometimes we hear about irreversible climate changes and inevitable changes. Is the cake baked, so to speak, or is this what's inevitable as we go forward, that our islands are going to disappear and along with our coastal communities?
You know, there so much is about decisions we make, right? And so climate change is a legacy problem in that the greenhouse gases we emit today stay in the atmosphere for a very long time. So somewhere, you know, up to 40% of the CO2 we emit is still going to be there in the atmosphere more than 1,000 years from now, still warming the planet, right? And so decisions we make now have a long-term effect on the climate. The other kind of legacy is that if the world all decided that we wanted to eliminate CO2 emissions, we probably couldn't do so tomorrow. The transition takes time, right? And so that also creates a legacy. And so with that, there are some changes that are somewhat fated to happen at this point, but then there's a lot that we have control over. I think over the very long term, loss of land due to sea level rise and the impact it's going to have on communities is probably one of the biggest concerns, right? Because sea level rise, you know, happens slow compared to the daily news cycle, but it, you know, but the decisions we make now are going to determine the sea level rise far into the future. So when you hear scientists or you just read in the news a talk of wanting to avoid 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius of global warming. It's just the numbers that have been thrown around a lot. The reason for that isn't that the day that the planet is 2 degrees warmer than it was in the past is the day the sea level suddenly jumps 5 meters. But the fear is that if we let the planet warm that much, we're going to trigger the processes that would lead to that sort of sea level rise in the future, right? And so then it becomes a question of what are we able to adapt to, right? And our ability to adapt really depends on your resources, whether it's money, equipment, or in some cases, literally the resources, like how much material do you have to build up your beaches, right? And so in a place like Kiribati, which is a developing country in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, it's somewhat physically isolated and it's somewhat politically isolated. You know, looking at 1 to 2 meters of sea level rise, it's hard to see how Kiribati is still going to be a place that people are going to be able to afford to live in. And so it's a really big concern. But then you can say the same thing for parts of Florida, for parts of Louisiana, and for parts of the part of British Columbia where I live.
I spent a lot of time in Nicaragua. My daughter has lived there on and off for a few years, and I visited a western coastal community of Nicaragua called Jiquilillo, and then I've also spent time on an island about 50 miles into the Gulf on the other side of Nicaragua, and that island is called Little Corn Island. There's two islands out there, Big Corn and Little Corn. Mm-hmm. And Little Corn is a 1 mile by 1 mile square island, no cars, delightful community, and it's easy, you know, as you can imagine, 1 mile by 1 mile, it's easy to walk around from side to side and around it. And one thing that startled me is to when I recognized that their freshwater source in the middle of the island is only a couple feet from the coast. And I was just standing on this one bridge and looking on the one side, seeing the ocean, looking on the other side and seeing the freshwater. It's pretty clear with sea level rise that once the salty water contaminates the freshwater, the island's still there, but it's no longer livable, essentially. I suppose they could boat in, you know, bottled water, but that's just not sustainable. And I think that's a big concern, too. Before the islands disappear, they may not be livable. Is that your sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And Doug, it's a really good and important point you're making. I think the misconception that comes across sometimes in the news is that the sea level's rising and places are just slowly sinking, Right. But it's more complicated. I mean, islands, particularly islands that are sandy, right? So they've got sandy beaches, et cetera. They, you have to, when you're thinking about how they're affected by sea level rise, you think of it like balancing a bank budget. You need to think about how much material is being lost, right? What are the withdrawals? But you have to think about the deposits as well, because every time there's a flooding event or waves or everything, sand and material, gravel, et cetera, can be deposited on the island as well. And so you have cases, actually, of islands that, with moderate rates of sea level rise, can still actually grow a little bit. But that doesn't mean they'll be inhabitable places, as Doug is saying. That the real concern for the Pacific Islands you see on the news, including the places where I work, is not that they're going to disappear beneath the sea. It's they're going to just be so prohibitively expensive to live in, because the groundwater is going to become salty, right? And that can kill all the vegetation. It can, you know, obviously lead to not having enough fresh water for people, et cetera. And so the picture is more complicated than how it's often presented. But what it means is that the impacts of sea level rise, you know, will be happening before you see islands disappearing. But it could be severe before you see anything disappearing beneath the sea, right? And in fact, you know, Doug was talking about farmers earlier. This is a really big concern for people who do farming in, like, the major river deltas in the world, including the Fraser River right here where I live. People withdraw irrigation water often from the river, and as the ocean levels keep going up, sea level goes up, the rivers get a little bit salty, the coastal rivers get a little bit saltier, and then it challenges your irrigation or the groundwater you'd be using. So it really is a global problem.
I read another story about Kiribati and how it's anticipating the coming changes. And while we all want to be hopeful and optimistic, it does make sense, as you're saying, when you think about budgets, people try to budget for their future. You know, they want to retire someday, so they save money for that. So some forward-looking individuals in Kiribati have been thinking, you know, what are we going to do? We're not just going to wait for this to happen. We're going to have a plan, a backup plan, a plan B, as they say. And the former president, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right, Anote Tong, he believes.
Got it.
Okay, he believes it's too late. This article said he purchased it, but I'm assuming he purchased it on behalf of the nation, not out of his own funds. But at any rate, about 2,000 hectares of land was purchased in the Fiji Islands a few years ago, with the idea of someday having to relocate all the people from that island nation to Fiji. And you know, that's hard for most of us to wrap our heads around, that to think someday, you know, you will no longer be able to live where you are, and you're going to have to, along with all your neighbors, just get up and go to some other part of the world. And let's assume that these people are going to be happy to have us come live with them. And, you know, when the evidence suggests that we're not really happy, that Europeans aren't real thrilled about Syrians coming to live in Europe, also kind of climate refugees because of what's happened in Syria. What are your thoughts? I mean, if you think about humanity, I'm a psychologist, so I look at it from that perspective of how the mind works and how the psychology of relationships. So we've got some really huge problems going forward as the climate crisis develops and unfolds, as people start moving, you know, immigrants start, you know, massive, mm-hmm. millions and millions of people. And, you know, I know you've thought about this and just wondered what your thoughts are.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I might actually throw a small little bit of cold, maybe some tepid water on some of these concerns, actually. Climate change, you know, is, you know, influence, it can influence wars, it can influence famines, it can influence migration. But it's rare, it'd be highly unusual that climate change alone caused migration, caused a famine, whatever, right? There's all, it's, these things are multifactorial. It's all sorts of things that influence somebody's decision to move between countries and everything. So even in a place as vulnerable as Kiribati, if we wanted, if the world wanted to spend enough money, we could find a way to have it adapt to even really high levels of sea level rise. We could build up the islands and everything. And in fact, for those of you that have heard about the islands that China has been sort of built, quote unquote, building in the South China Sea, they're building them, these islands, basically, they're geologically very similar to places like Kiribati. And so it's just that the Chinese government's willing to put enough money into it, right? And so I think that kind of extreme case is sort of a reminder of, it's about what we're willing and able to do, not just about the numbers of climate change, right? And so in Kiribati, in fact, this became a big political issue because the Anote Tong, the former president, traveled around the world a lot talking about how Kiribati is doomed and we need help migrating to other countries, we need a long-term plan, et cetera. And in fact, he left office because there are term limits in the country, but he probably wouldn't have been voted back in because people in Kiribati were upset with him because, yes, they all agree that climate change is an existential concern, but people in Kiribati are just like Americans. They worry about health care, they worry about education, they worry about, you know, they worry about their kids' futures and stuff. And I think people felt like he was giving up too easy and wasn't paying attention. And in fact, a friend of mine there, my friend Ariatara Ram, used a saying in a speech about a year and a half ago that I really liked, and it's, I won't bother trying to say it to you in the local language, but it basically translates to, you can keep crying, but don't give up. You know, and that really is the spirit of people there that doesn't get communicated to the rest of the world, right? Which is that, yeah, absolutely, cry if you have to. There are dangerous times ahead, but then let's get up and try and do something about it. And that the, even though some levels of climate change are, you know, we're already approaching quite dangerous levels of climate change, and there's more baked into the system because of past emissions that we've done, we have an opportunity to choose how we're going to respond, how we're going to adapt, and choose how much we're going to reduce emissions in the future. So let's get up and do something. And that attitude is actually quite common in Kiribati. It's not a place that is very defeatist, and it's not a place where most people want to leave. And I think it's a shame that story actually doesn't sort of get translated around the world.
If you're just tuning in, this is KKRN FM, 88.5 FM, and I'm Doug Craig, and our show is called Wake Up Call, and we have a very interesting, intelligent, and fascinating guest today. His name's Dr. Simon Donner. He's a climatology professor at the University of British Columbia, and he spent a lot of time on a group of islands in the Pacific Ocean called Kiribati. And are you familiar with the documentary film Anote's Ark?
Oh, I am, yes.
Okay. Any thoughts about it? You recommend it?
Yeah, so for I'm not sure if it's available on any streaming services or anything, whether it's easy to find. Yeah,
okay.
It's a beautiful-looking film, and I think one of the things that's wonderful about it is it tells a story of Anote Tong, the former prime minister, the former president, traveling around the world to raise awareness about climate change and the plight of people in Kiribati, and also about a family that's been migrated, I believe, to New Zealand. And I think, in my mind, the best reason to see it is just to get a sense of how the beauty of Kiribati. It was filmed, created by somebody who's a photographer, and I believe he was making his first feature film. And so it really is rich. You get a sense of the lush colors of the lagoon and everything, and just sort of a bit of a sense of life there. I think it tells the story in a particular way. I think there's other ways to tell the story. I do recommend seeing it, but also I do recommend people thinking about a little bit of what I was saying before, that you shouldn't walk away from that film thinking these people are doomed and they all have to leave, right? But that there's things that they can do to adapt, and there's things that the rest of the world can do to help them as well, through international aid, et cetera, and through telling the story in different ways.
I want to talk about climate optimism in a minute here, but I wanted to touch on climate denialism first, and then we'll get to the we'll hopefully end on an optimistic note, which is always a good idea when we're talking about the climate crisis. In our community, you know, our Congressman Doug LaMalfa is a climate denier, and the political climate is so conservative here in Northern California that any city council member or board of supervisor probably would have difficulty getting elected if he or she came out and admitted the human role in climate change. And I was also surprised to learn that the current president of Kiribati is Taneti Maumau, if that's right, I'm not sure. And he believes climate change is real, but he doesn't believe it's man-made. I'm just wondering, as a scientist who, I spent some time talking to you back at a climate science conference a few years ago, and you impressed me with just being so logical and rational, the way your mind works. And I just wonder how you feel when you find these people have these emotional thoughts and reactions that are not based in science, but they're just as convinced as any scientist that they're right. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about this remarkable denialism that's especially prevalent in America, but I assume it's also in Canada and other places, what your thoughts are.
Well, I think the first thing to say is when you look at the actual data on this, climate denialism is not that common, but it gets a lot of attention, right? And so really, denialism, people who just absolutely do not believe this and are not going to change their minds, is less than 20% of Americans and arguably potentially even less than 10%. And my concern, and this has been a frustration of mine, I think Doug and I, Doug was referring to a meeting at which we met, and the meeting was about climate change communication. And my concern often with the training and efforts that go around climate change communication is so much of it is centered around trying to convince the denialists, right? But, I mean, and I think while denialism has been a major obstacle to action, I think we're sometimes making a mistake by not just trying to speak to the other 80% or 90% of people, particularly sort of the 60% in the middle. You know, most people in North America, they know about this, they kind of think it's real, they're not really that concerned, they're a little bit confused, they're not that engaged with it. And those are the people that we need to be talking to the most, and I think we pay too much attention, actually, to denialism, and particularly at the political level, obviously it can be extremely frustrating in the United States, but there is a sort of groupthink and tribalism to it. And, you know, if you look at Congress in the United States, the Republican Congress, I don't think you'll find there's maybe three or four Republican Congress people that will agree that will openly agree that climate change is caused by human activity. But the majority of the rest of them probably also think that, but it's not politically expedient for them to say it, right? And so I think if there's a reason to be upset with them, wherever you are in the political spectrum, Republican, Democrat, Independent, be upset with them because they're lying, right? They're lying out of political expediency. And so that, to me, is frustrating. But the actual denialism out there, I think it's still quite small, and then, you know, it's taken a little bit of a hold, obviously, in the U.S. presidency, but I think the world's moving beyond it.
So we have less than 10 minutes on the show today. It's just zooming by as it always does. And so grateful that you've taken some time from your busy schedule to talk with us today. And I want to finish on a up note. And this was your idea, and I agree with it. You know, I didn't even know there was something called climate optimism. So when you told me about it, I did some little bit of research, and I'm sure there's different forms of it, different ideas about it. One thing I found at the Climate Reality Project was something called the five stages of climate optimism. We've all heard of the five stages of grief, and there is something called climate grief too, which I was thinking about when you said keep crying but don't give up. I mean, that seems to go to the heart of it. We can grieve and be optimists. But these five stages of climate optimism, at least here, was it starts with the last stage of climate or of grief. We know some of us know that the five stages of grief is denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance. And the five stages of climate optimism start with acceptance and then community, inspiration, action, self-care. So I love all that. But just to give us your thoughts about climate optimism, because I think you strike me as a very energetic, optimistic person. You're focused on what you can do, not what you can't do. You're not worried about what others are doing. You're just waking up each day doing what you can do. And just wondered how that works for you in your life with climate optimism and how you can help us be there as well.
Well, I think Doug is a psychologist. I know you appreciate this, and I think many of the listeners do as well. I mean, how we respond to news or information says more about us than it says about the news or information often, right? And so I get asked, you know, there's such concern about climate change these days, certainly since last year's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. A lot of people are scared, particularly a lot of young people. So I get asked all the time through the media, but often in class by students at the university, should I be worried? Why are you scared? How do you feel? And, you know, I've given a lot of thought, and I'm actually quite optimistic, but I think I'm optimistic about us solving climate change because I'm just an optimistic person. And so when I hear, you know, when I think about all of this, I just think of the opportunities that it creates. Now, to be clear, I don't think we can reduce I think it's unlikely, highly unlikely, we'll reduce greenhouse gas emissions fast enough to avoid 1.5 or 2 degrees of warming and some of the dangerous consequences that will come with that. But I do think that we will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and hope significantly enough to avoid some of the worst consequences that come with more warming than that. And, you know, for me, it's just about this being this incredible opportunity, and it's like the story that doesn't get told, and it kind of drives me crazy, and I don't feel like the Climate Reality Project quite does this either. I mean, if you think about it, right, like the activities that we're talking about that cause climate change, right, burn fossil fuels, which means burning coal, right, in power plants, which means burning gasoline, oil, you know, gasoline that comes from oil in our vehicles, right? These activities also create air pollution, right? They are the main cause of air pollution on the planet, and air pollution in the last century killed more people than the world wars combined. It was the killer of the 20th century, right? And so when we talk about moving off of fossil fuels to solve climate change, we'd also be eliminating the thing that killed more people in the 20th century than the world wars, right? And somehow we never talk about this. Like, there's so many co-benefits, like other good reasons to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, then we don't even need to lead with climate change. Right? But somehow this doesn't get talked about. And so I just feel like there's such a good, there's such amazing potential. I feel like there's this other story, there's this story that's just not ever being told. When people ask, you know, if I can continue, Doug, when people ask, like, what's the world going to look like in 50 years, right? Scientists always answer with what the impacts of climate change are going to be. And then, like, how about answering what the world will be like if we solve climate change, right? The fact that they'll be able to sit on a downtown street, right, and not be bothered by any exhaust from any vehicle. There'll be no soot landing on the awnings of the restaurant you're at, right? I mean, there's so many incredible benefits, just for human health, for the environment, et cetera, from the actions we need to take to reduce climate change, that just seems like such a good thing to be doing, right? And I just wish that story got told more.
And I came across an article that talked about how new technologies, you know, like cell phones at first aren't adopted that readily, and then just one day they seem to take off. And I think an optimistic view is that's what's coming, that we're just on the verge of this new green revolution. Do you see it that way?
I do. And, you know, so, for example, California has been quite aggressive towards electric vehicles. My province of British Columbia and the country of Canada as a whole sort of is. And in BC, where we have largely power from hydro, we have a pretty close to zero emissions electricity system. Shifting electric vehicles makes a lot of sense, right? So the government's being somewhat aggressive with its legislation, and you see Teslas, Nissan Leafs on the roads in Vancouver and everything. But what's incredible about it is that you need to back calculate, right? So if we're saying we're going to have like half of vehicles sold by 2030 are going to be electric, think about what that means for a decision now or 5 years from now. If you're buying a gasoline vehicle in 2025, right, with the thought that it'll have a resale value, will it? Because 5 years from then, it's going to be mostly electric vehicles being sold. And they're not going to be that interesting, you know. And so as soon as, I think we're quite close to a threshold where, which we've seen with other technologies, where you go from, you know, only 2% of the population using it or 5% of the population using it to suddenly it jumps to 70, right? And I think that's true of a lot of low-carbon activities, right? Whether it's about the type of vehicle, you know, for example, electric vehicle, whether it is about whether you own one yourself or not, or you belong to a shared car network, which is incredibly common in Vancouver, right? It reduces people's use of vehicles. So and just that's one example to point to. I think we've seen it, like you said, Doug, with cell phones. And I do feel like it's coming in a number of areas.
Our time is up. I'm so sorry. This has been great. So grateful to you. We've been speaking with Dr. Simon Donner. He's one of the good guys, one of the heroes who's fighting for the truth. He's just fighting for the truth every day, doing his research and his teaching and stepping out of the ivory tower, as Naomi Oreskes once said, and just kind of letting the world know, hey, this is serious. We need to pay attention. And we're very grateful to you, Simon. So thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thanks so much, Doug. And thanks to all of you for listening and really thinking about this issue.
So you've been listening to community-supported KKRN 88.5 FM. We're supported by listeners like you, brought to you by volunteers from the community. Please donate. Go to the website, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button. You can also call 530-337-1101 to volunteer. And coming up next is Tom Hartman. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
This morning.